John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show, Hotel Mars Episode N. My colleague and co-host and co-pilot David Livingston of the Space Show, and we're going to suborbital. Why? Because there's money in it, and Dan Derda. Dr. Dan Derda is a principal scientist in the Department of Space Studies of the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. He's also a customer of suborbital, and he's looking to be a passenger in suborbital. So, Dan, it's a pleasure to have you here. First, I want a general definition for the public just coming to. Why are they talking about suborbital? How is that important? Don't you want to go to Mars? Why is suborbital surprisingly rich now in competition and dreams? What does it do, and what does it mean in addition to the thrill of civilians flying at the top of the atmosphere? Why is suborbital an advance for space engineering? Good evening to you, Dan.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here. And hello, David, as well. Let's see. You know, I've been a big fan of this sort of next generation of suborbital capability since it was being hatched just about a decade ago or so. And the reason I see it as a great opportunity is we've always had the promise, right, from back in the shuttle era, even, right, more frequent, less expensive access to space. And for me as a research scientist, I view that as a good thing from the perspective of being able to work in my own environment. It's an extension of our laboratory, right? Marine geologists have gotten to go down to the bottom of the ocean for decades, and Alvin and other vehicles like that. Botanists go out and they go to rainforest canopies all around the world to do their research in the field. And this is a chance, this capability finally offers the space scientists that chance to get to the space environment in a relatively routine and pretty inexpensive way compared to the way we've been able to do it in the past.
So we're looking at an experimental laboratory that you can expend up to the upper atmosphere and get your results back quickly.
Yeah, that's right. And this is basically the Alan Shepard special. But what we mean by suborbital versus orbital, these are various types of vehicles, rockets, winged space planes, and so on, that get you boosted out of the atmosphere on a parabolic trajectory, a ballistic trajectory, if you will, a little bit of time above the atmosphere, above the Kármán line, above out into space, the international definition over 328,000 feet, a little bit of an arc over the top, 3 or 4 minutes of microgravity, depending on the flight provider. That offers a lot of different capabilities. The chance to transit through the upper parts of the atmosphere on a routine basis that are difficult to reach either by, it's too high for balloons or too low for satellites. This is a chance for extended microgravity, more than you can get on a relatively inexpensive parabolic aircraft flight. People line up in droves to experience 23 seconds of microgravity to be able to do their experiments. Think what you can do at 3 or 4. And this is also a chance to get, again, above the atmosphere and conduct certain types of astronomy out the window, or depending on the vehicle, you might be able to have in your telescope, your optics, your instrument mounted on the exterior of the vehicle for that chance to observe outside the atmosphere for those wavelength windows that you can't reach from the ground, ultraviolet and infrared and so on. So there are a lot of different capabilities here. Also, let me just also name another one just right off the bat before I forget it, is the really interesting opportunity that, for life scientists, the folks who are interested in the adaptation of the human body, if you will, to the space flight environment, to those initial moments of microgravity, that are hard to be focused on with a busy shuttle crew or so on that's, professionally having to get their vehicle ready for, an extended orbital stay and so on. This is a chance to see what a variety of different, fitness levels and different human beings, not your typical healthy test pilot, is going to be able to respond to. So it's going to provide a wealth of data for those folks as well.
Thank you. David?
So far, Blue Origin seems to be the only one that you can get experiments up on. Can you give us an approximate cost, and how long do you have to wait in order to fly on Blue Origin?
Blue is indeed flying right now since since the April 2nd flight, which carried the first of the Pathfinder payloads, myself included, along with Josh Caldwell and his colleagues at the University of Central Florida. But, you know, the other, I have to, you know, to be fair, you know, Virgin is manifesting experiments as well, and I'm sure as soon as their vehicle is ready to go, they're going to be probably carrying things in a very similar way. But, you know, all of these, you know, the exact costs for a payload from provider to provider vary a little bit, but, you know, probably within a factor of two or three or so. But they're all sort of in that, you know, $100,000-ish class, plus or minus a bit. And that can vary depending on, you know, how much payload you want to carry and so on. So it's pretty much in that sort of ballpark. And you can contrast that with the costs that, you know, for sort of the traditional sounding rocket program that folks have flown for decades, which is, you know, on the order of an order in magnitude greater than that. Of course, there are different capabilities, and I'm not saying this is necessarily a replacement for that, but it's another, you know, tool in your toolbox to be able to apply to get your investigation into the space environment.
I want to look at the scale of suborbital now in competition. We've mentioned Blue Origin. That's Jeff Bezos, Amazon. Blue Origin is already with its new Shepard rocket and capsule getting ready for human flight into suborbital, but Dan is talking about using experiments. There's also Virgin Galactic, which has a division now that is going to take experiments in addition to civilians, customers, passengers. And there was X-Corps, which had the vehicle Lynx that is now out of the business. Do you know any others that are entering in? Do you get I email all the time as a customer for other suborbital opportunities in the future, Dan?
Well, sure. There are other great assets flying out there. Masten Space Systems and Near Space Corporation. And although you may not normally traditionally think of this as a suborbital in the sense of thinking of rockets flying up and out of the atmosphere at supersonic speeds, but Worldview, based in Tucson, Arizona, is also going to be offering the capabilities to get you into that sort of near space.
Is that the balloon? The balloonist?
That's the balloon platform.
Wonderful.
And people have been, you know, again, you can sling telescopes and do all kinds of great things there. You might not think you can get microgravity there, but I bet you they're even thinking of ways of doing certain, you know, certain drops from their platform to be able to do these sorts of things. And one thing a balloon platform will offer you, of course, is a much longer period of time loitering at altitude. So if you're interested in, you know, in-situ atmospherics, for instance, that's a great capability for you. So there are plenty of platforms out there, and that's a good thing because put yourself in the customer's seat, somebody looking for the best possible platform to get the most benefit for your particular experiment, it's a good thing to have that sort of a, you know, smorgasbord of options to choose from. So that's a good and healthy thing. Will they all survive? I don't know. And that's part of the excitement of this business. We've seen that X-Corps has at least altered their plans. I think at this point, we maybe ought to let them speak for themselves in terms of, counting them down and out permanently. I think officially their statement is that they're kind of holding back at the moment and focusing their attention in other areas. But we'll see how that all works out to be fair to them.
David?
Dan, are the space tourists going to go up on the same flights as the research projects, or will they be separate flights, or will it depend on a different set of variables?
Yes. Are you going to be sitting next to your experiment, Dan?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me expand on that a little bit because, we were talking about, of course, experiments flying, and that's certainly in these early days. I think that's, you know, probably a prudent thing until we see how things work out. And certainly the funding agencies like NASA are being a little cautious at first until, you know, the vehicles are proven before we start putting the researchers on board with their experiments. I think ultimately that's the desired goal. Ultimately, I for sure would like to fly with my payload because nobody's going to conduct my experiment better than I will. But then, of course, you know, then there's the situation of, am I going to be flying next to the person who's like, you know, whoopee, and would you help me with my selfie, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I think most of the flight providers are already, of their own volition internally, probably considering that, any paying research customers are probably going to fly separate from, the space tourist, kind of flight. And I think that's, of course, a good thing, because your requirements, for the environment within the vehicle, the level of seriousness, the level of quiet, the level of restraint and focus and attention to detail and so on is going to vary, between the researchers and the tourist crowd. And, you know, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think it will be a smart thing to separate them. With the proviso, and I will offer this, as I mentioned, the life sciences folks, I know for a fact that many of the paying quote unquote tourist customers have already indicated that, you know, look, a lot of these folks want to fly to space for the same reason that many of us do. We've been fascinated with, the astronaut life in general for the last decades, and want to feel a part of something greater than just, you know, just yourself when you're flying. And many of those customers have already expressed that they would be more than willing and very happy to help out with experiments of some sort if they were to be able to. And so I think even on those tourist-only flights, many of those folks might volunteer to be wired up with biomedical measuring, equipment and so on to help with the life sciences folks. And that's a great thing, and I certainly would encourage that.
We're speaking to Dan Derda, Dr. Dan Derda. He is at Southwest Research Institute. David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show, is here as well. And Dan has introduced me to the possibility that we're going to have first class, second class, and gyro-gyroloose class in the suborbital flights. And when we come back, I want to talk about what Dan is anticipating for suborbital flight. This isn't, we're not selling tickets here. We're talking about the next generation that are going to go, who are going to grow up with the idea that a flight in space is just as possible as when I grew up thinking about flying over the Atlantic to Europe. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Hotel Mars, Episode M. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Dr. Dan Derda is here. Dan is at the Southwest Research Institute. He is a scientist, a space scientist, a principal space scientist. He's a customer of suborbital flight. He's also a man who plans to hold a ticket to get on suborbital flights. David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show, is here with me as well. We're talking about the brave new world of suborbital flight. We've been concentrating on the experiments, but David, you introduced the possibility that this is going to be a thrill for those of us who are born in the 20th century, and just routine for those born in the 21st century. So, Dan, you being part of us, you were born in the 20th century. What are you anticipating that this is going to be like? That the experience of flying, say, let's name Blue Origin because it has videos up and invites people to watch. You're in a capsule. You're on top of a rocket. You're going to blast off. You're going to go 70, 80, 90,000 feet into the air, and then you're released and you parachute down to Earth. What are you anticipating, Dan, and the risk here? And what does your family say of this?
Well, what I anticipate is the ride that I've been looking to forward to for most of my adult life. It's that chance to get a little bit, it's sort of the civilian version, if you will, of the overview effect, that chance to finally get a view of our planet from above. And which every astronaut who's gone into space has said is an absolutely personally transforming event. And, you know, just at its root level, I think that's what most of us are looking for, is that fantastic view. Many folks are looking for that chance to dance and play a little bit in microgravity. For those folks who've flown zero gravity flights, those are parabolic aircraft flights. You'll know that that's an absolutely magic experience. And I think combining both, is the dream of, you know, like you said, half the folks who've grown up in the 20th century, I think, watching that. So that's the root of it, the root of that fascination. It's the ultimate thrill ride. Will there be risk? Absolutely. There's risk in everything. You're in risk hopping in your car to drive to the airport to take that vacation to Tahiti. But you know, every person individually will have to weigh, is that risk worth the trade-off of that absolutely fantastic, probably life-transforming event. For myself, I've chalked up that, and I think it will be. So I'm willing to go do it.
David, are you ready to climb into the Blue Origin New Shepard?
No, I'm not ready to do that, but I would like to make a couple of orbital rounds of Earth and maybe go outside the spacecraft when that's available. So are you seeing any ideas of when those kinds of tourist experiences might be ready, Dan?
I do believe those are going to come. Most of these companies that we've been discussing, suborbital is the entry market, I think, for most of these companies. Of course, it's, this is indeed rocket science, and going beyond orbital, suborbital to orbital is going to be a far more technically challenging endeavor. But most of these companies we've been talking about have that as a subsequent goal as well. And I think it may take a decade or two longer to get to that point, but I think we're going to ultimately see that. I hope it can still happen in my lifetime. I think it probably will. Companies like SpaceX, which haven't focused on suborbital, have gone directly to in some cases, just directly to thinking about getting us onto Mars, for crying out loud. Those capabilities may come sooner than we think, and that's a great thing.
Right now, Dan, because I want to concentrate on the commercial aspect. My reading of what's going on with suborbital is that it's about all of the experiments that are lined up, all the research institutes. Everybody's getting in line with this. They're looking for funds. They're writing grants. Is that what you see at Southwest Research? Because I'm on the outside reading in. Is that what's going on? We're looking at they're scaling up very quickly here.
Yes, indeed. There are a number of, we just in fact had I can't remember which number it has been of our Next Generation Suborbital Researchers Conference here in the Denver area a couple weeks ago. And, there were a few hundred attendees describing their interest in being able to fly on these vehicles to do their experiments. And so from a number of different organizations, both academic and industrial, commercial, all the way up to, other government agencies, Department of Defense and NASA and so on. So again, it's just another tool. It's another It's another opportunity to get your research done. So you betcha, when the capability is there, people are going to definitely want to exploit it.
Dr. Dan Derda, principal scientist at the Department of Space Studies of the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. He's a man who's flown a great deal. He's flown the Hornets. He's flown the Starfighters. He is a man in pursuit of being an astronaut, and he was part of the NASA astronaut selection, and now he's headed to suborbital space soon enough with his experiments in the gyro gear loose section in the front of the aircraft. David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N.